I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The acclaimed author Shayam Silvadurai joins me now. He's just published his latest novel, his third, The Hungry Ghosts. In it, Siobhan is a man in his early 30s who has, to bridge the gaps in his life, he's got a dying grandmother in Sri Lanka, who one reviewer called one of the most complex and believable Asian female characters she'd read lately. They have a fraught relationship. He's got to bridge the gap between his native Sri Lanka and his adopted homeland of Canada. Siobhan also has to deal with his sexuality in the context of his family and their cultural background, and being a homosexual in 1980s Canada. I'll get Mr. Silvadurai to tell us about this book, his characters, and perhaps to enlighten us to the two pressing questions that most interviewers might have for him. Why so long between this book and the previous one, Cinnamon Gardens? And how much of him is in this new book, as perhaps was in his first book nearly 20 years ago, Funny Boy? The website for more is at shyamsilvadurai.com. The Hungry Ghost is published by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Shyam Silvadurai. Mr. Silvadurai, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Those questions that I posed in the introduction,
yes.
I mean, I'm sure you're asked that a lot, and,
yes,
and we'll take the first one. So why so long between Cinnamon Gardens and this book?
Well, various reasons. I think one of the reasons is that I really wanted to try and capture the Canada that I came to with my family, which is the what are known as the inner ring suburbs of Toronto, places like Scarborough, for example, where we ended up. And it's a very amorphous no man's land, really, when you're coming from somewhere else. But it isn't really a no man's land. It's a very specific place. And trying to get at its specificity while at the same time trying to convey the fact that it felt like a bleak no man's land was very hard. For some reason, I really had a lot of struggle with that, with trying to get it captured. And there was nothing else I had read or was finding that talked about the same sort of suburban landscape in that particular way, and I felt I wanted to write about it with the same sort of sensual specificity that I write about Sri Lanka, and that just took me a long time. So that was one thing. Then I, soon after beginning the book, I became very interested in Buddhist philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't call myself a Buddhist because to me Buddhism is a religion and has all the other problems that organized religion does have. But I was very taken by the philosophy. For me, I find it's a very sensible way to live my life. And so I wanted to somehow find a way to incorporate that into the text in a way that was organic to the text. And then I started to read a lot of Buddhist stories and to see how writers had dealt with very different philosophical concepts from, say, the Western concepts, which inform our narrative and form our narrative structures. And I got very interested and excited at the possibility of using different narrative structures in my writing. So again, that took a while to incorporate that all into a novel.
How did you get hip to Buddhism?
I don't know. I guess, like most people are looking for something. I mean, I wasn't looking actively searching, but I was aware that I needed some sort of philosophy, I guess. And then I read Karen Armstrong's biography of the Buddha. Anyway, I grew up in Sri Lanka is a Buddhist country, but the Buddhism that I was aware of was a very punitive kind of Buddhism, the Buddhism of the grandmother in the book. And yet Karen Armstrong's book opened up a different way of looking at Buddhism. I mean, for example, I didn't know that it was an urban religion, that it came out of sort of the fact that people found themselves in urban centers and were removed from their kind of familiar rural settings and didn't really know how to think of their lives, how to negotiate a life in an urban setting. I had no idea that Buddhism was an urban religion. And of course, so then it makes sense, because you live in an urban, and I live in an urban environment, and one, it would be nice to have a philosophy that matched how one had to live one's life. So, it's very interesting, I find.
And the title of the book is a sort of a Buddhist fable, is that
mm-hmm.
correct?
It is. The Buddhist, Buddhist thought or myth, a person who's very greedy or desires too much in their human life is born as a hungry ghost. And a hungry ghost is described as a being that has a mouth the size of an eye of a needle and an enormous belly. So it can never feed its hunger, and I think that's such a great sort of symbol for all of us. You know, we always want something more. Our desire, our need is never really sated. And of course, we live in a culture in which everything is attempting not to sate it, because, you know, I suppose capitalism runs on insatiable human desire.
The other question that people will ask is how much of you is in the character of Siobhan?
Yes.
This is not a biographical book at all, right?
No, I think of it as an autobiography of time and place and period detail and also of feeling, but it's not an autobiography of character or plot. In other words, I'm not Siobhan. I don't have a grandmother like that. But the experience of coming to Canada, for example, is very close to how I felt when I came here, both in terms of the act of immigration, but also in terms of feeling very alienated as a non-white person in a predominantly white gay community. And, you know, the detail of the basement in which he finds himself is a sort of an exact replica of the basement in which I lived in my parents' suburban house. So that, you know, it's kind of fun. I really enjoy that sort of aspect of putting in those details of your life, memorializing them in a way.
Yeah. Now, and I'm wondering how much of your own thoughts, your opinions, or beliefs feed the story and the characters. And I'm curious to know, you can say things in fiction, I'm sure, that you couldn't say in an interview like this, or in an op-ed that you might write for the newspaper, or a speech that you might give?
Like what kind of things, for example?
Well, the book has a lot of things with regards to politics, to race relations,
yes,
to sexuality, family relations. Is there something that you're trying to say about those things, perhaps?
Well, I think that we live... if I was going to say them in an op-ed piece, I would say them if I wanted to do that. There's no hesitation around saying that.
But there's something unique in fiction that a writer can do, right?
Yes, I think what the writer can do is the writer can take you into the world of those people and make you see the world through a different lens. I mean, the fiction I love to read, and I suppose the fiction I love to write, is the kind of fiction where you feel you're like a fly in a wall, in listening in on a conversation you would have no access to, except through fiction. And fiction tends to also humanize these issues, the so-called the issues of race or whatever. But my feeling about politics in fiction is that it's sort of like salt to food. You know, I think if you've got too much politics, it spoils the taste, and if you've got too little, the fiction is insipid. So you just got to get the right amount in there, just a little bit, because I think we all of us live our lives against in the context of political and social structures that also define and shape who we are.
Was there something you wanted to say about Sri Lanka and, I'd say, the political situation of the last, say, 30 years, even today?
Well, it's hard to just say it in like sort of a, you know, to encapsulate what I would want to say in a sort of soundbite. But I think the issue that the book is, or the theme that the book is trying to deal with, is the notion of reconciliation and how one might have to move on despite what's been done to a person. And can you actually move on when there's no acceptance of having done wrong, you know, by the perpetrator? So those are the issues that are important to me, especially in Sri Lanka at the moment, where, you know, the war is over, but we say it's post-war but not post-conflict, because the old conflicts still continue in new forms.
And so you live part-time there, do you?
Yes, I live about 4 to 5 months there, yeah.
Yeah. So it was, what, 13 years, was it, between this book and the last one, is that right?
Yes.
Now, are you working on this the whole time? I mean, I know you have other jobs in the sort.
In between, I did write a children's book, Swimming in the Monsoon Sea, and I edited an anthology of South Asian literature, but it was sort of, this was the ongoing project, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and so how long are you able to put it away or not think about it and do other things? Or is it always in the front of your mind?
It's always in the back of my mind. And I sometimes see. The front. It's you know, it's like any other nagging problem, you know, that you can't seem to unravel.
Yeah. What does it feel like for you when you go back to Sri Lanka? Like when you step off the plane?
It feels like I'm just arriving at another home. I mean, it just feels so familiar now that I just, you know, fall into my routine when I arrive there, you know, switch on my Sri Lankan phone, you know, just go through the motions of, it's just so familiar. I mean, sometimes I miss the kind of alienation I used to feel in those early years when I used to go, you know, where because that alienation is kind of interesting and important for a writer of fiction. But now it just seems so, you know, just so familiar. I come there, I know where to go in the airport, I got my phone, you know, put some money in it, and then I take a taxi, and then on the way I have to buy this and that and this, and then I arrive in my apartment, and there I am, and there's the apartment.
Yeah.
And it just feels like you just pick up your life. It's like a little bit of a commute.
Yeah, and so do you feel closer, say, to Canada or Sri Lanka? I mean, does one feel like home more than the other?
They both feel like home, but different homes.
I see, yeah. The Toronto, or the Canada, I should say, that you depict in the book is much the same experience that you had when you first arrived in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's, I mean, it has changed, hasn't it, for say, new immigrants that come here now?
Well, it's changed on in the level that there's many more immigrants of various backgrounds in Canada now. But it's also changed in that it's got harder to make a life for yourself here than it was when we came in the 1980s. It was much easier. There were more jobs. I mean, you know, my entire tuition, for four courses was just a little over $1,000, you know. You could actually make that in a summer. You didn't have to go into this incredible debt that young people have to go into now. So even though the process of immigration was hard, in the 1980s, it was that old kind of Canada that we came to. But now, if you're coming in here, it's sort of more of a winner-takes-it-all sort of Canada that we have created in the last little while, you know, where it's really, really hard. It's much harder, I think. I don't know how people do it anymore.
Yeah. The character of the grandmother, I mentioned her in the introduction. That's something that a lot of reviewers have talked about when talking about your book. What was the genesis of a strong character like this? I mean, you said your grandmother wasn't like this, right?
No, but I do come from a generation of people who, a lot of us had grandmothers like that. They were women from the rural gentry who married into the urban gentry, and they brought a more robust idea of womanhood with them compared to their urban counterparts who were sort of following more the kind of delicate Victorian flower model which they inherited from the British, you know. And so these women just, you know, for them the idea of home extended far beyond the home. It extended to managing the estates, the houses, the careers of their husbands. I mean, my grandfather was a doctor, and he'd have to give his pay packet to my grandmother at the end of every month, and she would lock it up in her cupboard and then give him an allowance, which he had to pretty much beg for. So that was the kind of women they were, you know.
Yeah.
Their power came from the household, but it went beyond that.
And so writing a character like the grandmother in this book, is that fun for you?
It was fun. It was great to bring her alive. I mean, she was an easy character. Once I'd created her seated on her bed polishing her silver little teapot, there she was, and she was, you know, she just showed in and took over a lot of the novel. So.
Did you always want to be a writer?
I think I did in retrospect. I mean, when I was small, I used to write plays and stage them in my parents' drawing room. And so my parents thought, oh, that means he's artistic, we should encourage him in theater. And so I did a lot of theater in Sri Lanka, and then when I came to Canada, I studied theater at York University.
Mm-hmm.
But then I took a playwriting course, and I got really turned on to writing, and I just loved it, and I realized this is the thing I want to do. But in the 1980s, there were no South Asian actors, so So I just made a deliberate choice to switch to fiction and have never looked back since then. I think the life of the writer suits me, you know, the kind of solitude. I love to be alone. I spend lots and lots of time alone, and it just really suits my nature.
And does it feel like a job, like the conventional job that someone might have, say, writing?
Yes, to me it does. It's a 9-to-5 thing. I mean, I start in the morning about 8:39, go till about 12, then I take a long lunch break. I have lunch, I go for a swim. It's very important, I think, for the creative process to let things, you know, gel and stew inside of you. And then I come back and do another session from about 3 to 6. So, and I do that Monday to Friday. Now, not all writers work like that at all, but that's how I work.
Yeah. And so, what's it like now that you're going across the country promoting this book that's been with you for a long time, and now people are getting to read it, see it?
It feels good. It feels really good to have finally got past it. You know, to have got through it and past it. And I think. Yes, I think it feels nice. It feels really nice. And, you know, it's really nice to be in Vancouver right now, of course, because the weather is so gorgeous.
Yeah.
And, of course, as you know, part of our book is set in Vancouver, because he does move to Vancouver, and the last part of the book is set here. So.
Now, you'd lived here, a year ago or so?
I didn't live here a year ago. I've come and gone a lot from it. And last fall, I was writer in residence at UBC.
I see.
So I'm very familiar with Vancouver.
Yeah, and do you think that familiarity is why part of the book is set here?
Yeah, well, yes, partly, but also I wanted him to go somewhere very far from Toronto. And it seems to be a sort of literary trope that people escape various parts of Canada to come to Vancouver. It's sort of the golden place, I suppose, you come to, like Atwood's protagonist in the Cat's Eye escapes to Vancouver, as does Margaret Lawrence's character in A Jest of God. And those are two books I really love, two Canadian books I really love. And I wanted to kind of honor the tradition, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and see, I've never been to Toronto. So I always find this curious about how Vancouver is perceived by people from where you live. And I guess we see that in this book, right? I mean, if I'd read the book, and when I read this book, I will see sort of the perceptions that people from the central Canada have of here. Will I?
Yes, I think so. Yes, I mean it's not an idealized, glorified kind of Vancouver, but it is the Vancouver that it is, which is it's a really beautiful place, and you arrive here, and it's really pretty, and it's not. Especially if you're coming from Toronto, it's not, you can't sometimes, now I'm sort of more familiar with it, but initially it took me sometimes I'd have to remind myself I was in Canada, you know,
mm-hmm.
It felt like a different place, because, you know, also landscape and weather and things do shape human beings, they shape how we are and how we move, for example, and how we think, so, you know, the milder temperature of Vancouver, the lushness of it, the mountains, they all shape how people are here and make them in some sense different from people in, say, Toronto.
Well, when you write a book like this, do you set out with a particular reader in mind? Like, do you think there's
I always have an ideal reader, and my reader for this book was my family and our friends and people like us who came to Canada at that time and who are very, who have the same sorts of backgrounds and same sorts of thoughts about what it means to come here. But my understanding, and I really do believe this, is that as a writer, the more specific you get, the more universal you end up becoming. And so I don't worry about, what's my market going to be? Oh,
yeah.
Will the average Canadian, whatever that term means, understand the book. I just don't worry about it. I take it for granted that people. I think I just have a lot of faith in people's ability to empathize across these boundaries, so-called boundaries.
Yeah. Do you read the reviews?
I read a few, and then I just don't bother after a
while. The ones for this book have been pretty good, though, haven't they?
They've been really good, so I'm pleased about that.
Yeah. While you're on tour, do you find that you have the time to write?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I need my regular routine in order to write. I envy those writers who can write in their hotel room, but I'm not one of them.
And so are you working on something now?
I'm contemplating something, but I'm not actually working on it, and I don't say very much more about it.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. I look forward to reading the book this summer. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
ShyamSalvadore.com is the website for more. The book is called The Hungry Ghost. It's published by Doubleday. ShyamSalvadore on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Potter.